fans. Welcome back to Corbett Report Radio. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan. So wherever in the world you might be listening to my voice right now, thank you so much for tuning in for tonight's broadcast. And tonight we are going to go around the world, all the way to my home of Canada, to talk about a topic that is near and dear to my heart. And that topic is about, something that I think should concern all of us. And it's something that's actually all around you each and every single day. It's in the air that you breathe. It's something that you're dealing with right now, something that you're receiving all the time, something that's happening inside your mind all of the time, and that has the power to change your perceptions of the world. What is this mysterious force that I'm talking about? Well, it is nothing other than language. And you'll have to forgive myself, being an old English major at heart, that this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart and something that I spend time thinking about. But it's always good to find someone in the alternative media and someone with an alternative perspective to the news that and politics that are taking place around us who also devote themselves to this type of very important topic. It's something that so many of us take so for granted, the type of language in which we are steeped that shapes our political consciousness and in turn shapes the world around us. But I think it is something we should not take very lightly. So that's why I'm honored to have on the line for tonight's edition of the broadcast our old good friend, Andrew Gavin Marshall of AndrewGavinMarshall.com. And for those of you who haven't been paying attention to BoilingFrogsPost.com, well, A, why haven't you been? But B, you will note that Andrew Gavin Marshall has his podcast there, Empire, Power, and People, which just keeps getting better and better every week. And recently he tackled the subject of political language and the European debt crisis, an interesting topic any way you slice it. So I hope people will check that out. Let's bring him up on the line. Andrew Gavin Marshall, it's great to have you here tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me once again.
Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit about Empire, Power, and People, because once again, I'd just like to reiterate to people that if you're not subscribed, you really should be. It's an incredibly informative podcast week in and week out and so much detailed information. So, Andrew, perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about the podcast and how things are going now that you're 28, 29 episodes in.
Yeah, somewhere around there. It's kind of shocking to think about that. But yeah, it's basically just a weekly podcast show. The amount of time that each show takes varies, but it generally averages around 45 minutes or so. And just like the title of the show, Empire, Power, and People, the subject is quite broad, but it's always it's generally focused on whatever I'm researching or writing about that particular week. So the past several shows have been very much focused on the European debt crisis, on Greece, on what's called the Frankfurt Group, and like you mentioned, on political language. And it just really takes a very critical look. It's often just a 45-minute rant of mine, but I definitely try and fit in as much information and as many facts as possible, just strewn within my own analysis. And because it's on Boiling Frogs Post, I'm really given free rein to really pursue the topics and my perspective as I discover them myself. So there's no control over what I talk about. It's totally free for me to go whatever direction I please, which is the most amazing thing. And it really just allows you to explore the topics in certain detail. In some cases are very broad in others, but
that's right. I think it does both. I mean, you give a lot of good structural analysis, but you also drill down into the nitty-gritty details. And that's exactly what I'm hoping to do tonight as we start looking at this topic of political language. But on that note, we're coming up against our first break, so let's take a short breather. We'll be right back with Andrew Gavin Marshall of AndrewGavinMarshall.com right after these messages.
Hey, meat eaters, the freeze-dried guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dried guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The Freeze-Dry Guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes 6 number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the Freeze-Dry Guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
If you would like to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself from anything out of balance concerning cardiovascular or diabetic circulation problems, then this might be the most important ad you'll ever hear. It is possible to acquire a 100% organic nutritional supplement for a healthy heart and circulation, which works. It is extremely effective and starts to work within days. For a long and healthy life, order today by calling 866-295-5305. 866-295-5305. A healthy heart is a happy heart. Order online at heartandbody.com. That's heartandbody.com.
In 2010, millions of people were awakened to the question of what? Now the next question that remains to be answered is, why in the world are they spraying an investigative look into one of the many agendas associated with chemtrail geoengineering programs, weather control? Why in the world are they spraying? Premiering and streaming live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying? Order your copy today at www.whyintheworldaretheyspraying.com. Watch the premiere live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying?
And if you control the weather, you're going to control the planet. It's that simple.
All right, welcome back to Corbett Report Radio, friends. And for those of you out there watching the video podcast, let me apologize for that first segment there. I lost the video momentarily, but we're back and we are broadcasting in video. So once again, the video podcast available from CorbettReport.com as a download just a few short hours after this broadcast airs, along with the show notes for the episode and all of the other information you need, including the website of our guest, Andrew Gavin Marshall, at andrewgavinmarshall.com, where you can go and find the very article that we're discussing in some length and depth here tonight. We want to talk about political language and how it shapes the political reality that we live in and can really, really shape the public perception of a number of issues in key ways. And I'm not just saying this as someone with a language fetish who was a former English major. This is actually something that we have to deal with and has been written about before by Orwell and others, and I think they knew what they were talking about. But for tonight's conversation, let's take a look at an article that Andrew Gavin Marshall posted up to his website in the last few days. He posted an article called Austerity, Adjustment and Social Genocide, Political Language and the European Debt Crisis. So Andrew, let's hear a little bit about this article and how it came together.
Sure. Well, it sort of just kind of sprung up while I was doing research and writing about quite detailed about the various aspects of the European debt crisis, really looking at the policies of austerity and what's called structural adjustment or structural reforms, looking at the rhetoric of the leaders who propose these policies, and then looking at the actual policies that are taken, and then, of course, looking at the effects of what's taking place in Europe, the reactions against these policies, what they actually result in a social real level for people down at the bottom. And then it really sort of just kind of happened that I started delving more into the use of the language itself. because, I mean, like you said, you were an English major and really studied this. Well, I've been studying political science for several years, and somebody once asked me, what's the science of political science? And I said, it's the science of BS, because, you know, the first thing you learn, if you graduate with a degree in political science, all you really know how to do is to talk your way through anything, how to constantly speak without saying a single thing. And it's really about how to argue your way through situations and issues that you may not know anything about. In classes, you're given positions to argue. You get to choose this side or that side. You may not agree with it morally or principally, but you have to argue it. And so you learn to simply justify the unjustifiable, and you learn to use language. There's no class in political science called how to manipulate language to your benefit. It's just a byproduct of the educational process itself. And having gone through several years of studying these types of things in school, it's if you read the financial press, which I've been doing ad nauseum for over a month now, and for much longer before then, it's really, if you don't really understand the underlying aspects of what's taking place, what the policies and effects really are, everything you're hearing from the central bankers, from the politicians, it's basically nonsense. Like it doesn't really make any sense. And there's so much meaningless language, especially when you bring in the economists and the central bankers. They can go on these long tirades where at the end of it, the average layperson has no idea what's being discussed. But the actual words have so much meaning behind them. And the policies that are put into effect, such as through austerity and adjustment or structural reform, are devastating. And that's why I decided to write this article to sort of take a look at that process of how to translate political language into real terms which people can understand instinctively and materially in real terms, in human terms. So you take these otherwise meaningless jargon words like competitiveness, labor flexibility, growth, structural adjustment, fiscal consolidation, structural adjustment program, etc., and you translate them into basically the effects that they have. So the first step is, of course, to acknowledge the rhetoric itself. Then you look at the policies that are implemented. Then you look at the effects. Now, if the same program, if the same rhetoric and the same policies are pursued time and time again, yet the effects don't really match up with the sound of the rhetoric, then you can assume that the words actually have a different meaning. Because if it's an accident that, for example, you know, you look at the past 30 years of neoliberal reforms through the World Bank and IMF. This is what they did to Africa, Asia, Latin America for the past 30 years and more. And if you look at the austerity packages, the structural adjustment programs is what they're called, SAPs, the rhetoric is all about bringing growth to countries, making you know, debt sustainable, reviving their economies. It's all this nice-sounding, flowery rhetoric, but the effect is massive debt, massive poverty, social destruction, what some have called social genocide, and just abysmal situations for people. The powerful do very well in systems of structural adjustment and austerity, because it's a system where everything goes to them and nothing is left for anyone else. And so if you believe the flowery rhetoric that this will bring, you know, democracy and you'll live in a capitalist utopian paradise, it doesn't make sense. But if you look at how the policies are repeated over and over and over again, then there's a system in place. Then what you can deduce from that is that the words, this rhetoric, actually means something different. Because otherwise it wouldn't be repeated over and over again. If you make a mistake, you look at how the mistake was caused and you change the policies. But the policies don't change, so we can assume that it's not a mistake.
Well, that's interesting, because I myself have noticed that there is the introduction of certain words into the political lexicon at certain times when I think they want to move the agenda in a certain way. So even if we take that first word in the title of your article there, austerity, I think that was a word that was really introduced into the economic and political lexicon a few years ago. And I noticed that, I picked up on that. And at the time I put out a video about the meaning of austerity. And it was basically making that argument that they have introduced this word into our everyday language so that they can introduce us to the idea of this great sounding thing, austerity, austere. Oh, it sounds so great. Well, let's tighten our belts and, you know, do what's best for the society or whatever the case may be. Of course, all it actually amounts to in the end is basically cutting off our nose to please the banksters. But it sounds so wonderful. And I think this is the austerity example is just one example of that. But I think it happens over and over and over with these types of good sounding words that are introduced and used to cover for a host of sins. Perhaps we can talk about the ways these types of words are introduced into the public's imagination.
Sure. Well, I mean, like you mentioned, austerity was introduced at large a few years ago. It was really in 2010. Prior to that, I mean, people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, they've known this word for decades, and it's brought in ruin and poverty to their people. So we never really heard about it because it was only our leaders and bankers and corporate executives and politicians who were pushing it on the rest of the world. So we didn't really need to know anything about it. We didn't need to hear about it unless you were studying economics or political science. It never was really commonly heard. But it was really in 2010 that a consensus was reached among Western industrialized G20 leaders. It was at the G20 conference in Toronto, in fact, in 2010, where the leaders got together and decided what David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, referred to as entering the age of austerity. And he campaigned on implementing austerity programs in Britain, and he was essentially laughed at in Britain. But as soon as he came to power and suddenly the G20 said, hey, great idea, he began implementing all these reforms. And Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, the high priestess of austerity in the European Union, I mean, she uses these references to sort of Bavarian housewives who are known for being austere and, pinching their pockets, and it's a very noble, very German value. And it's presented as, you know, this national value. There's a sense of pride in austerity and all these measures. But what really happens is that, you know, this word gets repeated. It goes out, all the media repeat it, and they never really define the word. And that's where the real issue comes in. It's simply accepted. And I mean, like you mentioned, this goes for a host of political words, not simply in terms of the economic crisis itself, but just if you examine the political lexicon at large, you know, look at words like democracy, look at words like freedom, liberty. I mean, these mean different things to different people depending on how they define it. I mean, I don't think I would define liberty the same way, for example, George Bush would have defined liberty or democracy. And the word democracy is a very good example because it's been redefined so many times throughout its historical usage. And in terms of the modern conception of democracy, it can be traced to Walter Lippmann in the 1920s, writing about public opinion. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a very young political theorist and thinker. He was the most influential political theorist of his day. There's really no one comparable in the world today. The closest you could get is Zbigniew Brzezinski, which is saying a lot because he was far more influential back then than Zbigniew is today. And he redefined democracy. He really was the main force behind this. But he basically defined democracy as an elite project where it was to be governed by really intellectual elites that
through manipulation of the masses and manipulation of public opinion. Absolutely. Well, we're going to have
engineering of consent.
Exactly. Well, we'll have to leave it there. We're coming up against a break, but if anyone out there would like to get in on this conversation and add your two cents, we have the phone lines open at 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443. Or you can tweet your questions and comments at Corbett Report. But let's take a short breather and we'll be right back with Andrew Gavin Marshall, andrewgavinmarshall.com, right after this.
How would you like to own land? A refuge to escape from big cities, possible food shortages, the collapse of the dollar, or just a vacation trip is now available to you. Lots of fishing and hunting are available just across the Rio Grande River. Own your personal Colorado Wilderness RV lot within three stones' throw of the Rio Grande River for $1,395. Quarter-acre lots, county road access. All lots come with warranty deed. All just for $1,395. Call 785-672-3141. 785-672-3141. Or go online to coloradoriverlots.com for more information and to see photos. It is away from civilization, a good business investment, and a low-cost protection plan. Call today, 785-672-3141.
Meet Jerry D.
Hi.
Jerry and his family, like you, are very concerned about world conditions and have gathered many emergency preparedness items, including turtle tough shelters.
We have added two 24-foot turtle tufts to our supplies and feel very secure knowing our large family is ready for whatever the future may bring.
Turtle tough shelters are not tents. They are permanent yet portable four-season geodesic frame shelters that are as strong as a cabin at a fraction of the cost and are easy to set up, take down, and move anywhere. Available in two sizes. Get your Turtle Tough Shelter and accessories included at TurtleToughShelters.com. That's Turtle, T-U-F-F, Shelters.com. Or call 801-623-3288. That's 801-623-3288. Or see them online at TurtleToughShelters.com. Turtle Tough Shelters, your all-season home away from home.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Welcome back to the program, friends. Welcome back to Corbett Report Radio. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Tonight we're talking to Andrew Gavin Marshall. He's available at AndrewGavinMarshall.com. But of course, don't forget the People's Book Project at ThePeoplesBookProject.com. And he also has his Empire, Power, and People podcast on BoilingFrogsPost.com. So he's a little bit all over the place, and that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. So, Andrew, let's continue with our conversation here, looking at this article up on AndrewGavinMarshall.com, Austerity, Adjustment, and Social Genocide, Political Language, and the European Debt Crisis. Let's take a look at some of these other terms that have been thrown around, and as you say, quite deliberately left vague and undefined so that they can become many things to many people. Let's take a look at some of the words like, for example, labor flexibility. What does this mean when we actually start breaking it down?
Labor flexibility translates into cheap labor, exploitable labor. So it's really, this is a term that's mostly used by central bankers in the media. That's where you'll see its most common usage anyway. Politicians, I think, while they do use it, they take a couple steps back because for unions, for various worker organizations, labor flexibility does sound a little threatening to them. And they know this because they suffer under the results of flexibility. But basically what it means in terms of the word flexibility, it means that labor becomes flexible to the demands of the elite. So if you look at Europe, there's often what's called, for example, in Italy and Spain and elsewhere, it's called a two-tier labor system, where you have certain industries, and this doesn't really exist in the United States or Canada to the same degree, but you have certain industries which have been protected. So you can't fire individuals for economic reasons, meaning if there's an economic downturn, you can't start firing everybody. They're protected jobs, their wages are protected, their pensions, their benefits. They have all, and these are, this is of course the result of long, long struggles, you know, dating back to the 19th century. But you have the two-tier aspect comes in the fact that what is existing is the unemployed youth are left for either no jobs or contract jobs, internships. They're cheap, they're exploitable. And what happens, what results, is that you get this sort of pitting the labor against each other. So you pit the unskilled youth against the skilled laborers, and this creates all sorts of disparities. And this is what Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, has referred to as an unfair labor system. And it's unfair because you have these people with protected jobs who are so entitled, who are getting all these benefits, while all the flexibility is left to the youth. And so the solution is, of course, not to increase the protections for youth jobs and the youth job market, but it's to decrease everyone's flexibility, essentially, or to increase their flexibility and decrease their protections. So labor flexibility means that if you're a part of a union, you won't be. It means that if you have collective bargaining rights, soon you won't. If you have pensions, no, not anymore. If you can't be fired, well, get ready to be fired. And labor flexibility simply means that the labor force becomes cheap and easy to exploit. Now, if you look at Greece, they're implementing labor flexibility reforms. They're doing the same thing in Italy and Spain. It's resulted in, of course, mass protests, uprisings, and struggles against it. But in Greece, the step has gone even further with Germany announcing a 6-point plan for growth, which includes creating what are called special economic zones. Now, in the third world, these are often called export processing zones, which are basically little corporate colonies in third world countries, for example, in Jamaica or elsewhere, where you have factories owned or rented by multinational corporations where they don't pay any taxes. They import commodities, produce goods in the factories, which they then export, all free of taxation, no unions, no striking rights, and basically very cheap exploitable labor. And it's all provided by the host government. The largest one is in Bangladesh at a site called Chittagong Zone. And it houses something like 137 factories. Every corporation you can imagine has some sort of interest there. And it's very cheap. The average monthly pay is something like $48. And they're said to be they pride themselves on being the cheapest labor available in the world. And so, of course, all the corporations flock there. This was one of the first export processing zones created. The first was actually created in Ireland in 1959, but they really proliferated during the neoliberal era. This one was founded in 1980 by Robert McNamara of the World Bank. And now Germany is suggesting that they should create special economic zones in Greece to help what's called productivity, which simply means profits for corporations. That's what growth means as well. When politicians, makers talk about growth, it simply means profits. Jobs also means the same thing. When you hear politicians, you hear this especially in American political debates, it's all talking about jobs. Just change the word from jobs to profits and things make more sense.
Exactly right. Labor flexibility, jobs, competitiveness, all of this wonderful language to wrap up all of these horrible things. And unfortunately, a lot of people will go along with it because they never think to question the political language that's being shoved down their throats. But that's exactly what we're doing tonight. So let's take another short break. We'll be right back with Andrew Gavin Marshall right after these messages.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
answer it. How can I stop these annoying collection calls?
Imagine being free from your debt without settling and with no payment plans, no negotiating or filing bankruptcy, and no attorneys. What if you could eliminate the risk from all your unsecured debt in about 90 days and keep all your money? You can. It's called Zero Debt Guarantee, and it works. There's no other program of its kind on the planet, and we guarantee the results in writing. Call now, 800-477-9256. Let our team of experts provide you with the resources to fight back, stop collection calls, and prevent and stop wage garnishments and bank levies. If you're facing foreclosure, we can help. Don't go it alone. Get free information now by calling 800-477-9256. Talk to an expert who has also completed our program. Call 800-477-9256 for free info or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com. That's 800-477-9256 or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com.
Herbal Healer Academy's new summer specials. Our 500 parts per million colloidal silver, all sizes on sale. Organic liquid iodine, liquid cal, Meg, vitamin D, CoQ10 with hawthorn, colon enhancer, Super 2, natural laxative, our exceptional product, Connexin, memory power, and Super Male and Femplex. All on sale for the summer at herbalhealer.com. Also, 10% off on the HHA Survival Course. This is an important time to have this information. Might save your life. Nation's leader in supplying quality natural medicine and education. herbalhealer.com. Free online newsletter. Quality natural medicine supplier since 1988. We ship the same day you place your order. Free 128-page catalog with your first order. Go to herbalhealer.com today. herbalhealer.com.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Jimmy Carter says yes, friends. Our government can be competent. Just ask Jimmy Carter. And of course, that is ridiculous 30, 40 years later, when after the ridiculous nature of the Carter regime has been exposed. But it's funny to my mind that Obama, of course, is Carter Part 2, who was plucked out of the ranks by Rockefeller and Brzezinski, and basically the same crew come along and pluck Obama out of the ranks to catapult him into the highest office in the land, despite having absolutely no credentials for that position. And once again, just like Carter was sold with a bunch of hope and change, well, literally Obama was sold with hope and change. Those words, as if they somehow had some magical property that could transform the American economy and politics, and people screaming, "Oh, Obama's in power! I don't have to pay my mortgage anymore. Everything's taken care of." And of course, it was all just a ridiculous, unbelievable demonstration of the point of tonight's episode of the broadcast, as we're talking about political language and how it can be used to sell people on ideas that they would never go with if it was just told to them in plain language. So Andrew, your take on the Obama phenomenon and how he was sold like a tube of toothpaste and is probably being ready to be discarded as one by this point.
Well, that's actually like the perfect example. I mean, the hope and change campaign. If you look at the public relations press, which is to say the propaganda institutions of our society, the Obama campaign won all the industry awards in 2009 in the public relations industry for the best public relations campaign of the year. This was the first time that a political campaign ever in history beat a corporate advertising campaign. It actually changed corporate advertising. If you look closely at the advertising, especially in 2009, not so much anymore, but all the slogans were hope and change, and everybody was borrowing from that, and everybody was so jubilant in the discussions within the literature of the public relations press. It was all talk. They were just so unbelievably excited at the prospect of a politician having won these awards and really changed the game itself. And that's all it was. I mean, it was just they were words that were fundamentally meaningless. Hope and change. There was really no basis for either of them. I mean, at least not change in the right direction. Hope not in hell, but I mean, there was really, it was just sloganeering. It was quite impressive in terms of how it was done and how effective it was. But I mean, if you look at the actual campaign footage, it was everywhere you saw Obama, there was always those words very present in the background, on the podiums he was speaking at, on signs, everywhere. It kind of reminds you of George Bush standing on the aircraft carrier with Mission Accomplished banner in the background. He never actually said Mission Accomplished, but because it was simply there, that's very much associated with George Bush and with the Iraq War. Back in 2003 and with the so-called mistake of the Iraq War. But really, it was is the same kind of approach. And another great example with Obama was while he was campaigning, he was in some Midwestern town in the United States, and he was asked a question at a town hall meeting of it was a working town. And somebody asked, would you renegotiate NAFTA? Because NAFTA closed down their local factories, sent their jobs away, and people were struggling since then. And Obama said, yes, absolutely, I will renegotiate NAFTA. Well, the Canadian elite, and by elite I mean our bankers and corporate executives and political elite, went insane. The press was just in an uproar over the potential of the future president of the United States renegotiating NAFTA. I mean, our elite want to integrate. They're already very integrated themselves with the American elite class and indeed the globalized elite class structures. The prospect of a renegotiation is just, it's insane to them. So they flipped out. And what happened in turn was that the Obama campaign office actually called the Canadian embassy and said, don't worry, it's just campaign rhetoric. In other words, he's just lying. And sure enough, we now see that, yes, absolutely, he was just lying. It was just, you're in this situation, what do you do? I mean, you can't very well say that, no, I'm not going to renegotiate it. It was great for you. I mean, you lost your job after all. You can't really justify that to someone's face. So yes, I'm going to renegotiate NAFTA. And then privately tell the people who actually matter, because you don't matter, tell the people who actually matter that, don't worry, I'm just lying. I'm going to keep up pace with you. And in fact, if you look at Obama's trade agreements in the Pacific, they make NAFTA look like some sort of socialist-constructed, people-driven enterprise. I mean, if you compare the corporate input and profiting to this Pacific trade agreement, it's unparalleled.
It is indeed, and it's not something that I've explored a lot yet on this broadcast, so I'm going to have to get more into that, the TPP, than how that's developing. But once again, if people want to get in on the conversation, 1-800-313-9443. Andrew, do you think the public is becoming more susceptible to this type of political language because of the dumbing down of society, or do you think that the use of this political rhetoric as a scientific technique is becoming more advanced, or is it a little bit of both?
That's a tough question. Part of me thinks that it's just always been this way, in terms of how the language is used. I mean, the techniques for communicating the language are more advanced, simply by the technological advancements that exist. So the language reaches more people faster, more effectively than ever before. But in the same sense, because of those same technological changes, people are able to see around the language easier. So you're not simply relying solely upon what a politician tells you or what you see on your television. But the language itself is essentially, in one sense, becoming more globalized. You do have, I mean, just for example, the word austerity. I mean, this has become a globally relevant word from a period where it was essentially meaningless. You know, this will, of course, change as well. I mean, Europeans, they really know right now what austerity means. Currently in the United States and Canada, we're clueless still. We don't know. I mean, there's people who do know who are here, and they don't like it. But by and large, if you go out on the street and talk to people about austerity, they'll have no idea what you're talking about. But if you talk to the Spanish, if you talk to the Greeks, if you talk to the Italians and the Irish, they know what austerity is, and they know what it means. And they're waking up and rising up against it. And these words are now bad words to them, as they should be. But because we are still not really aware of the actual meaning of these words, they'll be able to impose it, I think, here, at least for a while. Because as it was agreed at the G20 meetings in 2010, declaring the age of austerity, it was for Europe really at that time to impose, and North America would take its time. But now we see with Canada that Harper has decided that now is the time for austerity. So Canadians will learn quite soon what austerity really means. But I do think that there is that changing factor in terms of whether it's more manipulative now than previous. I can't exactly say. I think it's always been manipulative.
I think you're right, and there certainly has, I think we could go back in time and even remember the Maine, and phrases like that have been used to drive people into wars that they otherwise wouldn't have wanted to be in, etc. So certainly I think jingoism and sloganeering has been around for at the very least centuries, and we have to understand that history. But again, I think you're right. I think that the techniques of manipulating and transmitting that information is becoming more advanced, and we see more pushes towards subliminals and then Fox News graphics and things like that to make the soft sell a little easier. But let's a discussion of political language in the English language, at any rate, without a discussion of Orwell, I think would be lacking something. Yes. So let's think a little bit about George Orwell and his seminal work, Politics in the English Language, where he wrote, for example, quote, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face and which do not square with the professed aims of the political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial or shot in the back of the neck or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic labor camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them." And once again, just an absolutely incredible essay. I hope it, for people out there who haven't read it yet, I hope they do so. But what does that say to our own current political day and age? From my own money, I think the more things change, the more they stay the same. But Andrew, your take on that.
Well, that's just what I was thinking. I mean, the population transfer, pacification, these are terms that are still used today. And that essay was written in 1946, I believe. So you have, like you said, some things, you know, don't change. And that use of political language, I mean, Orwell was talking about a declining British Empire. When I think of those words today, I think of the declining American Empire, because the same terminology is, in fact, used throughout the American Empire. If you look at even, for example, defining terrorists, defining freedom fighters, you know, for example, the Contras in Nicaragua, these were, you know, these were death squads, essentially. drug money funded terrorist outfits trained by the CIA. These were, in the words of Ronald Reagan, freedom fighters. They were fighting for what we called democracy, which meant dictatorship. And you look at the same thing with Libya today. I mean, or last year, it was the democratic uprising. There was nothing democratic about it. These were freedom fighters, liberators. The fact that they were, by and large, militant, Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist outfits is irrelevant because those are facts. They are the freedom fighters of Libya, and so that's what you refer to them as because that creates the imagery that you desire. And even if you just look at when the Egypt uprising was beginning and the power structure in the United States was not yet sure how to approach the situation entirely, you had Hillary Clinton making statements calling for calm on both sides. What exactly does that mean? You know, you have a ruthless repression, a violent repression of a population out in a square who are armed basically with rocks. But Hillary Clinton is calling for calm on both sides. That frames the imagery of, you know, both sides are making mistakes and having faults. Whereas, well, you compare that to Syria today and you're not hearing for calling for calm on both sides. You're arming one side against the other. So it changes. It's you could call it hypocritical, but that implies that it has the possibility to not be hypocritical. It's like claiming that the United States lies. It assumes that it has the ability to tell the truth. You can't really state that your political leaders are lying because, again, it's hard to imagine a case in which they don't. That's just the way things function. It's like accusing, you know, an infant of lying. It doesn't really make sense, but it's all about the imagery that is constructed in these situations. And you, again, Bahrain, you look at Bahrain, there's not even discussion on Bahrain and what's happening there. So it's not merely a matter of being hypocritical. It's a matter of how you frame the imagery. And that's done through language, as you said. And it changes from place to place, but really the game is all the same.
Well, exactly right. And exactly in the case of Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or some of the other places where we've seen unrest happening, of course, if they don't talk about it, it's like it doesn't exist. So that's another way in which the absence of language can be used as a manipulative tool. But Andrew, we've been talking about the ways that this can be used for manipulation of the population and suppression of the population and pulling one over on the population. Is there a counter strategy by which political language can be used in a conscious way to actually inform people of what's happening? Is there a positive spin that people who are working in the alternative media, for example, can put on this to actually affect change in a positive way through this language?
Well, I think that, first of all, yes, there is a way that it can be used to the benefit of knowledge, to the benefit of what you could define as liberty, I guess. But it really comes down to an act, which is to define the language you use. It's not simply to define the language being used by the elites, which is necessary. I mean, if you write a report, for example, on the European debt crisis, and it's all about austerity and adjustment and what's taking place, but you don't define these terms, you're not going to really be informing people. You're going to be repeating things that people can then repeat themselves. But there's no really transfer of knowledge itself or accumulation of knowledge. If you define the actual terms, and then you can go into all the details of the policies and effects, etc., but you have to actually define the terms that are used. And the same goes in terms of general alternative political ideas, ideologies, the concept of liberation itself. I mean, the words that the alternative or the resistance, media resistance populations, movements, they have to also define their terms. And they don't really do this. You hear a lot of talk of freedom or of democracy or of liberty. But again, these terms aren't properly defined when they're being used. And I think that that's a way to really expand the debate within the alternative media and between radical or revolutionary ideas and philosophies. I mean, just for example, if you were to have a hypothetical debate between an anarchist and an American libertarian, But you didn't define the term freedom. The debate would be nonsense, because the anarchist has a specific conception of what freedom means, which is very different from what an American libertarian has as a conception of the word freedom. The American libertarian views freedom primarily in terms of freedom for property, whereas the anarchist views often freedom from property, from private property. And if you don't properly define these concepts, the debate won't actually lead to anywhere.
Well, as an anarchist, I already disagree with your definition there. But that I think, is part of the point of real political debate, is coming to the understanding of the terms that are being used so that some sort of communication is at least possible. And on that note, once again, we're up against a break. So we'll come back to wrap things up with Andrew Gavin Marshall right after these messages.
Chlorine, fluoride, pathogens, and more are in the water you drink day to day. Do you want the ability to remove and reduce those harmful things in the water you drink? You can. How? With a Berkey water filter. A complete standalone gravity filter system that requires no electricity and no plumbing. Use for emergencies or for every day. Berkey systems come in 7 different sizes. Where can you get one? From GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com. With the purchase of each system, you get 50% off accessories, such as fluoride filters, water level spigot, and sport bottles. Plus, free shipping on all orders over $25. For a limited time, get 5% off all ceramic systems when you use coupon code RBN. Call GetBerkey at 855-GetBerkey. That's 855-438-2375. Or visit GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
A healthy heart starts with Extendovite. I've always believed that I had to have a strong defense to overcome the new superbugs of today. Extendivite, a 7-herb heart protection cocktail, not only helped me to overcome a massive heart attack, but it also has built up my natural immune defenses against colds and flus. Extendivite has so many benefits that we all should be taking Extendivite to build up our defenses for what superbugs might emerge yet. So start today, clean out the toxins, and be as healthy as you can be. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
All right, friends, we're back here on the final moments of Corbett Report Radio for another edition of the broadcast. Tonight we've been talking to Andrew Gavin Marshall of andrewgavinmarshall.com. Tomorrow night on the broadcast we have Syrian Girl lined up to talk about the latest in Syria as things seem to be coming to a head with the Battle of Aleppo. Very important broadcast tomorrow night. The night after that we have Richard Heathen, who is a Canadian activist who is working on Agenda 21 and related issues. Thursday night, we have James Evan Pilato of foodworldorder.com on the broadcast, and Friday night, we will be in the Friday night highlight mode once again. So another jam-packed edition of the broadcast lined up for you this week. And tonight, once again, we've been talking to Andrew Gavin Marshall. Many different websites you can find him at, the main ones being andrewgavinmarshall.com and thepeoplesbookproject.com. Andrew, for people who haven't caught our conversations in the past, perhaps you can just tell them a little bit about the People's Book Project.
Sure. It's basically a crowdfunded project that I'm engaging in to write a series of books, a radical, critical analysis of power, looking at the ideas, individuals, and institutions of power, but also the ideas and individuals and institutions of resistance, and looking at a wide variety of sectors of society, looking at the social, psychological, technological, scientific, political, economic spheres of society for the past several hundred years up until present. Sort of, it's asking big questions. What is the nature of our society? How did we get here? Where are we going? Why? Who's driving this? For what purpose? And what can we do about it? And the current book I'm working on is to really enter the subject, and it's a look at the present-day situation. It's a look at the global economic crisis and all the resistance movements sprouting up around the world against it, and trying to do sort of a detailed analysis of that to look at really the imposition of power and the reaction of people today. And then it'll go into the history with following volumes.
Excellent. And you are also, of course, doing your podcast at BoilingFrogsPost.com, as I mentioned before, Empire, Power, and People. And that comes out each Wednesday, is that right?
Yep.
Yes. All right. So people can look for that there. Well, Andrew Gavin Marshall, you've got so much on your plate and so much going on that it's always difficult to keep up, but I'm glad that you are working so hard. So once again, thank you for all of this.
Thank you.
And just before I let you go, actually, I totally forgot about this, but how is the maple spring turning out there in Quebec?
Well, right now it's a bit of a lull. After Bill 78 passed, it ended the school semester. But the school semester, which effectively brought the strike to an end for a while, although at the 22nd of every month, there's still a mass protest that still brings out tens of thousands of people into the streets, doesn't really get as much coverage, but it's happening. And the school semester is beginning up again to finish later in August, between August 13th and 17th, I believe. So the strike should be expected to start back up again with it. And on the 22nd of August, I'm sure we'll see a massive demonstration in the city as well.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to your coverage of that, as always. So AndrewGavinMarshall.com. Once again, thank you for joining us on the broadcast tonight, and thank you to all of you out there for listening in. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and once again, this is listener-supported alternative media, so if you'd like what you hear, please consider signing up for my newsletter or purchasing one of my DVDs to help me going, and consider clicking on that donate button on AndrewGavinMarshall.com to help him keep going and doing what he's doing. So on that note, I'm going to leave you all for another 23 hours, but until then, dear friends, parting is such sweet sorrow, but we must do it at least once a day. So thank you all for listening and take care.
Are you a guest?